Welcome back to the programme. Now, morning, Marion. Listening to Fianna Fáil, it's like reading part of The Last Supper when Bertie says to Micheál Martin and Willie O'Dea, before the cock crows, you will be in denial of me. What Fianna Fáil loyalty. As for the media print broadcast, large sections of them were cheerleaders for Bertie. What hypocrisy. Paul says, Marion, today's news regarding the major fundraiser in the UK offering access to the UK PM for major contribution shows how rotten politics on these islands are. And actually, it's pretty spectacular. The sums were considerably larger than were moved around in brown envelopes here, it has to be said. But as I say, more of that anon. Now, I don't know the source of that piece about the household charge, but I understand that a member of the legal profession sitting across from me has declared that he's not going to pay his household charges.
Yeah, I said yes. I'm technically
guilty as charged.
I was actually presenting a problem during the week. I had already registered. My office had registered, and in fact, I only found out during the week that I'd actually paid a household charge for one house because I have a small place in Dublin. And I have a place down in Wicklow, and I told him not to pay the second one, and I sent the cheque to Cromer Street Hospital. I just had 2 or 3 days presenting the programme, listening to people, and it's my way of protesting because this government are like the last government. They're just not dealing with the problem. They're afraid to deal with the problem.
Right. There's 100. Know your brake so easily.
Yeah, no, I was caught once for drunk driving, unfortunately, which I still regret. But anyway, no, but I just, no, it's a protest. Now, if I'm ordered by the courts to pay it, then I'll pay it. I'll comply with the court's order. But at the moment, and my reason for this is, and this is why I don't know why, you know, it shocks me when Brendan Howland stands up in the door and the question answers and says he doesn't know how many quangos there are. The maximum we can raise in the household charge is 160 million. There is 15 billion a year spent on quangos. 15 billion on quangos. And despite many promises and a wonderful part in the McCarthy report dealing with this, Fianna Fáil and the Green Party did nothing. Fine Gael are doing nothing. Brendan Howland doesn't even know how many quangos there are. So all I'm saying is deal with the issues and stop passing it on to people who can't afford it.
Are you against it in principle that you don't think there should be a property tax in principle?
No, no, I think there should be a property tax for those who can afford it. It's like everything in life. I'm dealing with, it's not. I'm dealing with people.
It's universal.
It's universal, who are taxi drivers. They can't put money in the car.
Yeah, but those who can't afford it, I think, are exempted.
Well, if you
are they're not exempt. They're not, Sam. No, there are people I'm dealing with every day of the week who work in taxis and small little business. They can't afford. The taxi drivers are struggling to put petrol in the car, or diesel in the car. There's 15 billion on quangos. There is a Senate that's costing us 15 to 20, 25 million a year. There is 36 local authorities for 4 million people. Where Manchester's 4 million people, one local authority. There's 44 cents. Can I just finish? There's 44 cents in every euro of 15 billion on health. That's on administration. They deal with the issues, but they're afraid to take on the unions. They're afraid to take on vested interests. And what they're doing is passive. And it just got to me. I presented a programme for 3 days and listened to people going on, and I said, they're absolutely right. And I'm listening to my own people coming into the office, and I had enough, and I said no. So out of principle, I gave it to Cromer Street Hospital.
Well, hope you feel better after all that rant, Gerard.
Sorry.
I mean, I find these kind of rants about so many quangos and this, that and the other. I mean, if you have evidence about things like that, you present the evidence.
Oh, it's there. It's McCarthy report. Did you read the McCarthy report?
Of course I read the McCarthy report.
And if you look at the McCarthy report on quangos, it's beautifully
laid out. There were quite a lot of things in the McCarthy report that I would have disagreed with, including saying that they should do away with the Law Reform Commission, which was the people who made the proposals to fix the debt law difficulty. And, you know...
The McCarthy report presented a menu of choices.
Yes, yeah.
Correct.
He wasn't recommending
doing away with them all.
He was just saying that if you wanted to save X amount of money, these are the things you could do. So he put the whole lot on the menu. Yeah. And it's a menu that has been largely ignored, unfortunately.
It has. And I'm not saying for one moment I agree with the entire report. That would be silly. What I'm saying is there's one quango set up to find out how many other quangos there are and where there's overlapping. There's another quango set up to see how they can limit the cost of all the other quangos. I mean, it is a joke. And all I'm saying is, until people realise, and I said this before on many other programmes, the debate is not between the public service and the private sector. The best people in this country are the frontline workers in the public service. It's between the frontline workers of the public service and the pen-pushing bureaucrats above them. See, that's the problem. When you spend 44 cents in every euro on health in this country, and Britain is 6 cents and Florida 7 cents, tell me what's the problem. The health services are flush with money. Flush with money. It's just not been used right. So take that on. And that is not generific, because there has to be a solution. You can't just keep knocking everything. And I'm saying the solution is there. All they've got to do is go at it and take it on. Run the country.
There are 34 local authorities in the country, and it costs almost $6 billion to run them. Excluding the amount of money they spend on roads, etc. But just $6 billion to run them.
When you say to run them?
Administration, staff.
Pay the wages and pay
the bills just to run them. $1.4 billion is raised through commercial rates on the business sector, and the rest comes from central government. You know, Jared mentioned the point that based on our population, you know, if we had one local authority per 250,000, we'd have 14 local authorities in the country, roughly. Okay, so there's a vast amount of money being spent. And unfortunately, the funding of local government since 1977 and that famous decision to abolish residential rates, the funding of local authorities has never been on a sound footing.
Yeah, mind you, that was another occasion when the good, plain people of Ireland went for it.
Absolutely.
The majority of 20 seats. Yeah.
But now that this residential property tax is an alternative way of funding local government. And I would agree totally with Jared's point there that the key thing we should be doing before any of this is reforming local government, getting rid of so many of those local authorities. If you, for example, abolish the $1.4 billion commercial rates bill for the business sector, that would give a huge boost to employment around the country. You know, so if you're talking about stimulus, this is the stuff you need to do. But in relation to...
But $160 million doesn't do much for that.
No. I mean...
But it's getting the basis.
It's a database.
It's getting the foot in the door you're doing with that, isn't it? Tell me, though, how much of that is... you know, people are objecting to this. People are always going to be angry. Who wants to pay any more tax of any kind? I mean, that's a natural enough phenomenon. But there is a resistance to how it is being administered and how the minister is going about doing his work. There is great resistance to him. Is his personality, do you think, Jim, getting in the way of correctly bringing in what you see as a proper tax?
No, I don't think so. I think the opposition to the household charge started day one, before Phil Hogan said anything, and it has just
it seems to have been growing, but I
think he's been made a scapegoat for this. You know, he has an unpopular policy to try and implement, and it's been done in a hurry, unfortunately.
I heard, and it's reprinted in one of the papers today, Olivia O'Leary's contribution in Drive Time. Yeah. She fairly sewed it into him, and that has been reproduced today, and there are many articles about. But things like people going into their post office and being told, sorry, you can't pay. People going into their county council and being told they can't pay. People being told to pay online. Not everybody knows how to pay online.
I heard Amy Gilmore on radio today saying you could pay through the post office, which is blatantly untrue.
Yeah. Well, is that not administration? Should the minister not have done the groundwork before he did the work?
I think Jim is right to the degree that Phil Hogan, as Minister for Environment, was obliged to start the process that the EU... IMF has said we must have a property tax.
Well, when we blame the EU, the IMF, the Troika,
you get worried.
Is there not a principle about whether or not there should be property tax, which would be much more dependable and widely spread,
and that's why the opposition from the group of TDs.
So rather than blaming the Troika, either is it or isn't it in principle a good idea?
I believe it is, we've reached a stage in this country. But I think that Phil obviously, I think, got hoisted in this tax because of the actions he took on the septic tank ones. I mean, I don't know where that advice came to him to reduce a fine or a fee of 50 down to 5. A lot of people that aren't paying this, I bet, are waiting around saying, well, if he did it with the other one, you know, if we wait, it'll go down to 50.
You make him sound like a victim there.
No, he's
the boss. He's the one who comes up with all the ideas.
I haven't seen no report as to whether it actually increased the number of people registering the septic tanks because it was only 5 years. I don't know whether that's happened. But that is something he shouldn't have done and has left him a bit exposed here. But I mean, Gerald Keane, as a lawyer, to advocate that people break the law. I just wonder.
He said he's doing it as a protest. Is that?
But it's breaking the law.
Yeah, it's breaking the law. And I mean, I'm wondering if a fully fledged property comes in.
Let me ask the judge.
it's breaking
go easy
the law.
On me, judge. Yeah.
Bring in the judge.
No, I feel really strongly that we have this kind of huge objection to property tax as such, but in principle, everybody in every other country in the world pretty well has a local property tax in order to maintain local services. And now, Gerard, you had a great rant yourself, and you needn't bother interrupting me. I do think that it has been exceptionally badly managed. First of all, the flat 100 euro is intrinsically unfair, but perhaps for 1 year it isn't an awful lot of money. People spend 100 euro on going out for drinks for an evening, and if
that's a lot of drinks now, Catherine.
Well, it's a fair lot of drinks, but if it was around,
and a nightclub, I think,
and then whatever.
If you cut back to less than a half pint per week.
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly. Yes. And I think that in Northern Ireland, there's quite a high level of rates. And the same people that are screaming about it here are administering it.
Sinn
Féin,
I think you're speaking about that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But I do think that perhaps Phil Hogan has not the right personality of way of getting across to people that they should pay it and that it's a good idea to begin with, rather than saying it's the law, you have to get out and pay it in a kind of...
But that's
of,
what
you know,
said to Gerald.
Yeah. Well, it is what I said to Gerald. But he's a big boy. Others may need more help.
At the risk of destroying my career by contradicting a very, very well-respected former Supreme Court judge, I totally disagree with you. Because it is ludicrous for Joan Burton, and I think you followed on the same tack, of comparing us to other countries. I suppose the advantage I have is that I'm dealing with ordinary people every minute of every day of my working life. And it's not fair to say it doesn't hurt them. It does hurt them. It does hurt many of the people I'm talking to. And we cannot compare like Joan Burton tried to say, you know, we have it in other countries. Because I'll tell you why. There are many countries that don't have refuse collection, water rates, commercial tax like we have, stamp duty at the rate we have, and all of these taxes. It is right to have a property tax. It's right for the people who can afford to
pay
that property tax.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm saying is it is wrong to hit the people of this country and then to pretend it's for local services. I have clients who are paying colossal water rates and they've no water. They can't even get water into their businesses during the working week because of some problems. It takes days to fix it. Out in Dunleary, if Rathdown is an example of many businesses I know. It is not fair to say that everybody can afford to pay it. There's a lot of people who can't afford, and it's not fair for the sake of 160 million when if they run some of these quangos more efficiently and follow some of the work, they'll make massive savings.
Be interesting to see what happens. People are quoting in the papers today the percentage that have registered, but I would imagine that always, even with income tax, people pay on the last day. I don't know. But we will wait.
Is the principle that if you think a law is unfair, you don't obey it? I mean, if I decide in the morning that I think the drink driving laws are unfair, can I go out and drink and drive? It's the same sort of principle. I mean, the law is the law, and once we start to disrespect it at this level...
Okay.
We need J. Edgar Hoover.
Yeah, I'm going to have to. I'm going to have to take another break, or I'll be run out of town. With us in studio, Catherine McGuinness, Nora Owen, Gerald Keane, Sam Smith, and Jim Power.
1850 715 150.
Welcome back to the programme, and we are moving on now to the stories that are making the headlines around the world and indeed here, let it be said, on international news. And we've been joined in studio by Tania Banotti, CEO of the Professional Institute for Advertisers in Ireland. We're going to start... First of all, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And we're going to start in France.
Yes, as all the papers today have a roundup of the Mohamed Merah, the shooter in France who killed both the soldiers and then the children and their parents at the Jewish school. So it's really kind of rounding up. What did we know about him? What, you know, it's a classic tale. Grew up in the banlieues of Toulouse. His father went back to Algeria and then he was radicalised. And why was he not on the French security services radar? And why did it take so long to find him? So there's lots of kind of thought pieces pieces about that. The most interesting piece I found, the only kind of new piece today, is in The Independent on Sunday, where it talks about the pregnant girlfriend of one of the soldiers that he killed is planning on marrying her deceased fiancé. And apparently this is legal in France. The things you need to do is you have to show that you've been planning to get married. The deceased family must give their consent and the president's office must give their approval. And Sarkozy has indicated that he's going to give his approval.
My goodness me.
So this 21-year-old Caroline Monet is going to marry her dead fiancé.
I presume she was looking for a father for the child or something.
I guess so, or perhaps because he served in the armed forces, there's some financial settlement that will come.
Let me go, if I may, just to Angelique Crisafi, Paris correspondent with The Guardian. And you've been following this story all week. That is to an Irish person now, that's really quite astonishing that one could marry somebody who's dead. But I just want to go back to the gunman himself and his brother.
Yes, I mean, in terms of marrying someone who's dead, we must remember that this young woman is 7 months pregnant.
Yeah.
She's in a terrible state, and they were going to get married. And I think it's happening as a way to deal with the grief.
Right, yeah. Well, yes, it's just very unusual. I don't think that, well, maybe it is elsewhere. But tell me about the man himself now and about his background and the fact that his brother, I think, has been pursued now by the authorities.
Yes, his brother's been jailed today pending an inquiry. I mean, basically, Mohamed Merah, what do we know about him? I mean, the whole of France is in a state of shock because there's two things here. First of all, it's taken the country completely by surprise. And I was outside the school shortly after the shooting. And I have to say, it's one of the most horrendous stories I've ever covered as a journalist. So on the one hand, France is in absolute shock. On the other hand, this is a young guy, he was 23, who had a history of violent crime and who was on the state security's watch list. So the biggest question in France is, was this preventable, especially the school shooting? Now, what we know about him was that he comes from not actually an area outside Toulouse, but quite near the city centre. Kind of area full of council estates, not quite as bad as the terrible ghettos outside Paris, but nonetheless very poor, very high unemployment, a lot of people struggling out there. Now, he comes from a big family of five kids. He's the fourth child. His father left his mother and didn't really have any role in bringing up the family. And one of his lawyers, who's very sympathetic, in fact, to Mohamed Merah, who he said as a young teenager was an incredibly polite boy and someone who was very tolerant, but he was also a kid who didn't do well at school. He was slightly off the rails. He was kind of growing up on the streets rather than at home. He could have gone the route of drug dealing, which happens in neighbourhoods like this. And instead, he went the route of petty crime. He was threatening people with knives. He stole quite a lot. And he finally, aged 18, went to prison for 18 months for stealing a handbag in a bank foyer. This was because he'd racked up so many convictions, 15 through the child courts, that by this stage there was no chance for a suspended sentence and he was sent to prison. And he thought that was a huge injustice. And now the security services are looking at the fact that it was in prison where reportedly he actually tried to commit suicide at some stage, that he really went over the top and sort of self-radicalized and really developed this utter hatred of France and the Republic. But I have to add here that when he came out of prison, he started developing kinds of behavior which already had the intelligence services alerted to him. So it raises big questions about why they weren't properly following him when the first shootings happened in March.
Right.
For example, he traveled to Afghanistan and Pakistan. He was picked up by the Americans there and flown straight back to Kabul when they found him in Kandahar because they weren't quite sure what he was up to there. He was then put on a no-fly list to the US, so America had his biometric details and he was not allowed to board a single plane to the States. He was interviewed only in November, only a few months ago by the intelligence services in Toulouse to find out what he'd been doing in Pakistan. It was a strange place to be going for this young kid who didn't have very much spare cash to spend on big trips. And he came into the police station with his USB key and said, look, I was on holiday and here are my pictures. I was a tourist.
And Angelique, was it true he said he'd gone to find a bride in Afghanistan, that was the cover story?
That's one of the cover stories, yes. But certainly he said he was doing a bit of tourism.
Well, I mean, I presume it's valid to go as a tourist to Pakistan.
To Pakistan, certainly. I think a tourist in Afghanistan would probably raise a few eyebrows.
Well, he was in the border. I mean, he was in the border where areas would be where people would be training in sort of jihadi camps.
Right.
Now, well, two, There's two things to point out here, which the French government is really under fire over this. Not because of his training to Pakistan, because you're right. I mean, he is able to fly wherever he wants. And that's what the Prime Minister would say. Look, we can't put people in prison just because they are maybe extremely religious, which kind of was and wasn't the case with this guy. He was more of a young delinquent. I mean, he'd been reported also very recently in the last couple of years for going around his mother's neighbourhood, brandishing swords at people and making young kids watch jihadi videos and locking them in cars and making them watch videos. He was always more of a violent boy than an overly religious...
radicalised boy.
Radicalised, very poised person.
And what about the brother? Why are they bringing in the brother?
He's quite militant himself, isn't he?
They're bringing in the brother. Yes, he is quite militant. He was suspected of, although he wasn't charged with, helping jihadist fighters go from France to Iraq in 2007. But he's not in prison. He's not being looked at now for that. He's being looked at the fact that he could have aided and abetted his brother in terms of trying to fix up the motorbike that was used for the crimes and perhaps buying other elements. So it's not 100% clear exactly what role he played, but certainly it's very important to the police to properly investigate him. And he's been in prison because he's considered not safe to bail.
Well, it'll be interesting. I mean, they did say that he was a very good gunman. I read that in one of the articles, so he obviously had training somewhere. Anyway, Angelique, thank you very, very much indeed for talking to us. And now we go to...
Well, we can do a quick roundup of what's happening in the States. Yeah. There's obviously the US Republican election drags on. Rick Santorum has just won in Louisiana, but it's believed that Mitt Romney is kind of unstoppable now despite that win. Yeah. So that election trickles on while Obama has gone to his first visit ever to the demilitarized zone in Korea.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, back in the States, obviously there's the Sergeant Bales who, speaking of killings, it sounds like this whole piece is about shootings, but who shot and killed 17 people in Afghanistan, 9 of them children. He's now been brought back to the States and he's been charged with premeditated murder on all counts, but he's believed to be mentally very unwell. So whether he'll ever serve time is kind of questionable.
Right. You also wonder sometimes, well, you don't have to wonder, you know, the value on one life over another life, you know, depending on what part of the world somebody...
Well, it certainly has got a lot less coverage than what happened in France, that's for sure.
Right. Okay, now...
On to the Middle East.
Yes.
We have the wonderful story of Asma al-Assad, the wife of Bashar al-Assad, and Bashar's mother, sister and his wife on Friday have all been put on an EU sanctions list. So all their assets have been frozen and they're now not allowed to travel. So she has been...
Well,
in
they're not allowed to travel.
To Europe.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's a very good piece by Patrick Coburn in The Independent on Sunday where he says, really, this is just the dampest of damp squibs, that if that's all we can do for Syria, it just shows how the EU has run out of options. Because frankly, you know, stopping spending sprees by Mrs. Assad in Harrods is not really going to end the tragedy of what's happening in that country. So there's a lot of coverage which basically talks about the impasse in Syria and how things are just not going to get better anytime soon. The army are responding. They're beginning to kind of fight back and win against the opposition and clear out areas. So it's going to be a much longer guerrilla war. And there's kind of lots of roundup of the coverage of what's happening in Syria this week.
Right. But as we heard on the programme last week, his father, I think it was in the city of Hama, murdered 20,000 people.
Oh,
in that area.
He is his father's son. Anybody ever thought he was a moderating influence? You know, his father was guilty of the most dreadful atrocities, and as is he, while his wife is shopping for gem encrusted jewellery in Paris. So, like father, like son.
Right.
But there's an interesting story, and it's a country I'm interested in, Mali in West Africa, which is kind of connected to everything that's happening in the Middle East at the moment. Because when Gaddafi was fighting, you know, about 3 or 4 months ago, he lured a lot of people to Libya to fight on his behalf and he offered them money. And some of those people came from a country called Mali, which some of your listeners may know. It's about twice the size of France, but it's only got 15 million people.
And its capital is Timbuktu.
No, its capital actually is Bamako.
Oh, sorry.
Timbuktu is... I've been to Timbuktu because one of its famous exports is music. Gold and music are
beautiful music.
Extraordinary music. And
isn't there kind of some woman, I just can't think of her name off the top of my head, it's one of the most magnificent.
Oumu Sangare, there's some wonderful, they're griots, these female singers. And it's a country that is well worth visiting. But unfortunately, the kind of blowback from what happened with Gaddafi was that these fighters left Libya when he was shot. He was no longer able to pay them. They returned returned with their weapons to Mali, and they've now joined an insurgency which is seeking to kind of liberate the northern part of Mali, which is the Sahara Desert. And these are these Tuareg tribesmen who dress in these indigo headscarves and ride camels. And they've come home to fight an insurgency. And as a result of that, all these soldiers were sent to fight them, and they were sent very badly equipped. And the army has revolted, and they have now taken power in Mali. All kinds of people are stranded there, including the Kenyan Minister for Foreign Affairs, who went to do business and now can't leave the country. So the land borders are shut. You can't fly in and out of the country. And it's not clear if this coup is going to last. But given that it's a country that we often hear very little about, it's interesting that lots of these African countries are being affected by what's happening in North Africa. The blowback is happening in Mali. Yeah. But business continues as usual. There was a piece...
It's, well, mind you, it's also one of the poorest countries in the world.
It is one of the poorest countries in the world. They do have gold. And it's interesting that, you know, one of the pieces in The Guardian today is a company called Rand Gold, one of the FTSE 100, basically saying, oh, it's business as usual. We're still mining gold in Mali, so we're fine.
Possibly they are. Whitney Houston. Now, there Whitney was a woman Houston. Who put everything... and indeed, her funeral got a level of coverage that was quite
extraordinary.
Quite extraordinary.
Yes.
Yeah.
I believe there's a clip from the Los Angeles County Coroner talking, giving the gruesome and grisly details about the autopsy and what it told us.
The final cause of death has been established as drowning due to atherosclerotic heart disease and cocaine use. Other drugs were identified during the toxicology process. Those drugs were all at the therapeutic or subtherapeutic level. They're not considered to be related to the actual cause of death. The cocaine use indicated an acute use, and it appeared that the cocaine had been used in the time period just probably immediately prior to her collapse in the bathtub at the hotel. The autopsy results indicated approximately 60% narrowing of the artery. So the finding of atherosclerotic heart disease suggests a cardiac event complicated by the cocaine use.
That's kind of tragic on so many levels. In a way, I was taken aback by the level of interest worldwide.
But the list of drugs in her system, I mean... You know, it wasn't so much drowning; it was everything that she'd taken beforehand. It doesn't make for easy reading, I'm sure, for her daughter as well.
Right, I'm sure it does not. But anyway, where are we going?
Well, I'm fascinated by this story of this woman who's been released from Somalia, and there's a lot of coverage in the papers today because she spent 6 months kidnapped by Somali pirates. And your listeners may remember that her husband was killed. They were staying in this luxury beach resort when these speedboats came in and they killed her husband and they captured her. And she kind of left the news. You know, we didn't hear much about her. But essentially her son, her 25-year-old son, was left to pick up the pieces. He had to negotiate her release. And there's a really interesting article in the Sunday Telegraph which gives us the scoop on exactly what happened to her when she was kidnapped. She was initially kidnapped by Al-Qaeda. They sold her for $300,000, if you can believe it, to another group. And then her son had to negotiate her release. And apparently...
Sorry, just take me back there. You say that with the pirates that...
The pirates that captured her...
Were the pirates Al-Qaeda?
The initial group were Al-Qaeda and they sold her on. And the reason that they sold her on is that the British government does not allow people to pay a ransom to terrorists, but you can pay a ransom to simple criminals. And this article talks about this international business of paying ransom to Somali pirates. It's based out of London and there are insurance companies involved, there are banks involved and a company called Control Risk, which apparently this 25-year-old son had to essentially sell the family assets. And it's believed he paid £800,000 to get his mother released. And I believe we have a clip of her. She is remarkably composed, talking about when I think she didn't know her husband had been killed when she was first captured.
I didn't know he died till about, I think it was 2 weeks. 2 weeks from my capture. I just assumed he was alive, but then my son told me he died. That was difficult. And it must have been hard for my son as well, very hard. I mean, he's been fantastic. He's been absolutely fantastic. I don't know how he secured my release, but he did, and I'm really happy. Can't wait to see him, really.
What, she does sound
I mean, her husband has died. She's got to go back home. And I couldn't believe how composed she was. But what was interesting to me is all the kind of the people that prey on vulnerable, on the fact that this family obviously wanted her back. For example, there's a man in Nairobi who's the one who drops the money into Somalia. He formerly worked in the British Embassy in Nairobi, and he now has the monopoly on these private planes that go and drop bricks of $100 bills in to get this woman released. So it's a bit tawdry, and the answer is be very careful if you're going to Kenya on your holidays.
Well, I'll tell you, it would put a lot of people off going to Kenya on their holidays. But I mean, you can see how governments are caught in such an awkward situation, because as soon as you start paying, you create an industry.
That's right.
If you pay for one person, it's worthwhile to kidnap another.
Although,
but if it's a member of your family,
you do anything to get them back.
That's the point, isn't it? Yeah, very difficult. Very, very difficult. Now, that story in the States about the young black boy.
Yes, apparently there's been uproar in Florida about a young 17-year-old boy called Tavon Martin. He was killed by a man called Mr. Zimmerman for no apparent reason. He was unarmed, and Mr. Zimmerman runs a very active branch of Neighbourhood Watch in his community. Apparently he had called the police no less than 46 times in the previous year to report people wandering around his gated community. And the police are heard on this, on an audio clip, telling him, do not follow the suspect, sir. Do not follow the suspect. He went, he followed him, he shot him, he killed him. And apparently, under a law in Florida called Stand Your Ground, he may actually not be charged with murder or anything else. He may get off scot-free. So there's been huge demonstrations in Florida, predominantly by the African-American community, looking for justice.
Right. And Obama...
Obama spoke up. I think he had to be quite careful. He said a full investigation needs to be had. But he said, if I had a son, he would look something like Tavon, and I would be equally concerned if I was his mother.
The funny thing about it is I saw an African-American on the BBC the other night giving out stink about Obama and saying that what he said was racist.
Well, it seems like he can't say anything right, can he? No matter what he says, it seems to be wrong with some of these Republican candidates. It struck me that his comments were quite moderated and careful, because Mr. Zimmerman may be charged, and if he is, you can't have the president saying anything that would prejudice his case.
Yes.
So he went as far as he could go.
Yeah, but anyway, this man put up a very good argument that would it be different if the boy had been white? Then he wouldn't look
like. But there seems to be a narrative here in Los Angeles and elsewhere that it's often black teenagers who are shot dead and they're unarmed, either by police or by neighbourhood vigilantes.
Right. We skipped fairly quickly over the Republican race.
Sorry,
but maybe
because I've had enough of it, but we do have a clip of what Rick Santorum had to say about his rival Mitt Romney.
In the last century, there is one Republican candidate that ever defeated a Democratic incumbent running for re-election. One in the last century. And that was Ronald Reagan. Every other time, almost every other time, we ran a moderate because we had to win. Republicans and conservatives were so worried about, you know, getting control back that we have to win. And so we have to nominate someone who's, you know, who can appeal to more. No, you win by giving people a choice. You win by giving people the opportunity to see a different vision for our country, not someone who's just going to be a little different than the person in there. If they're going to be a little different, we might as well stay with what we have instead of taking a risk of what may be the etch-a-sketch candidate for the future.
Etch-a-sketch. That's a great line. And apparently it's become the joke of the week in the campaign.
Right.
Because Romney's handler said that Romney himself was almost like Etch-a-sketch. You can shake him up and restart all over again when the election proper starts.
Well, the interesting thing is that I see that Michelle Obama is out now. We were talking about funding of politicians and politics earlier on. More or less drumming up business, looking for money,
sending out
anywhere
emails
she can get it.
Yeah, and what a powerful advocate she is.
Yeah.
Terrific.
Okay, listen, Tanya, thank you very much indeed for that. That's all from us for today. Today's programme was produced by Nolene Leddy, researched by Elaine Carraher and Claire Collins, on sound Alex O'Gorman. We'll be back with you next Saturday and Sunday, 11 to 1. Hope you can join us then. Meanwhile, really enjoy the weekend, and I hope it's a beautiful day wherever you are. Talk to you Saturday. Until then, a very good day to you.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. Sterling and dollars are commission free at the post office. Unpost. Do more.